this week's show, I am really looking forward to sharing with you a conversation with Professor Herman D. Farrell. Herman is Professor of Theatre at the University of Kentucky, and he's dedicated a large portion of his life to studying and interpreting the late, great Eugene O'Neill, of course, an American playwright who has had a massive impact on American literature in a global sense. So I'm sharing with you a conversation with Herman about his research into Eugene O'Neill, touching on aspects of his Irishness, etc., etc. Really delighted to have an opportunity to share with you that chat today. So, handing over to myself in conversation with Herman D. Farrell of University of Kentucky. Folks, enjoy. I'm delighted to welcome onto this week's show of This Irish American Life, Professor Herman D. Farrell. I'm speaking to him by way of the University of Kentucky, where he is Professor of Theatre. Herman, thank you for taking the time to chat to me today and for being willing to come on our weekly program, This Irish American Life. It's great to have an opportunity to chat to you.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm delighted to talk to you as well.
So can I ask you maybe, I'm guessing, or am I correct in thinking that you've had a long-held interest in Eugene O'Neill, or is your interest in him as a you know, someone who looms large in terms of American history, of course, Irish American history, and literature in major ways. Is he someone you've been long interested in, or can you tell us a little bit about your engagement with O'Neill in terms of your scholarship?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm a playwright, and I began, and I've segued as I've joined the Academy about 15, 16 years ago, to also being a scholar, and my scholarship is based in the study of Eugene O'Neill. But my first play that I wrote after college, I went to Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, was a play about the life and work of Eugene O'Neill. In my senior year at Vassar in 1983, directed a production of one of Eugene O'Neill's plays. It's probably his worst play. It's a play called Dynamo that he wrote in 1929, and there's a whole story about why it was so painfully bad. One of the things is that he was undergoing a divorce at the time, and he left the country and wrote it from France and sent it back, and it's one of the few plays that he never attended rehearsals for. Wow. But beyond all of that, O'Neill wrote this play, and I was given an opportunity in 1983 to direct the production in the Powerhouse Theater at Vassar. And I chose this play because something about it touched me, and I ended up directing it. But in my preliminary work leading up to directing this main stage production, I read one of Eugene O'Neill's biographies, and of course read through the major plays, Long Day's Journey and Tonight, Iceman Cometh, Moon for the Mist of God, and some of his earlier works as well. And so when I was reading the biography and preparing for the directing of the play, I just became fascinated with his life story. It is a riveting narrative. Anybody who studies O'Neill is fascinated by the great connection between his own individual life and his work. And so as a young, spunky 22-year-old, after I finished all of that, actually spent some time in London after graduating from college and saw a bunch of plays and hadn't really considered myself to be a writer, but had this idea that I might write this play about O'Neill, and I did. And subsequently, after coming back from England, I actually started at Fordham Law School for a few weeks and dropped out in order to write this play, much to the horror of my father, because he wanted me to be in law school. And so I ended up going to law school 3 years later. But I went off and wrote this play. It was called Dreams of the Sun, A Life of Eugene O'Neill, and it was done up on 91st Street in a very small theater in the West End, on West End Avenue, in a Greek church basement, beautiful little theater that they've had there since, I think, the 1920s. And so I wrote the play. It was not the greatest thing in the world, but it did give me the sense that I might be a writer. I wrote one really good scene within it, and subsequently, very long story short, is I ended up becoming a playwright as a result of all that. So flash forward several years to 2005, when I was coming on to faculty at the University of Kentucky. One of my colleagues suggested to me that maybe I might want to attend a conference in Provincetown that was dedicated to the study of Eugene O'Neill. There's a Eugene O'Neill Society that's been around since the 1980s, and it's an organization that brings together scholars and just fans of Eugene O'Neill, and it's been doing so ever since then. Every 3 years, there's an international conference. That one in 2005 was held at the at Provincetown, where O'Neill's work first came out. There was one subsequently, I think, in 2011 in Greenwich Village, and then there was another one. There have been several, and just recently there was one in Galway in 2017, and coming up in 2020 there's one in Boston. But as a long answer to your question, with that 2005 journey to Provincetown, I ended up writing a paper about a long-lost play of O'Neill's called Exorcism, which is about his own attempted suicide. And at that point, the play had been destroyed and missing, and that was in 2005. Interestingly enough, in 2011, the play was discovered and published, and it's actually helped many of us O'Neill scholars have a better understanding about O'Neill. And ever since 2005, I've continued to write and attend these conferences, to teach O'Neill in seminars at University of Kentucky. And so my love and interest and study of O'Neill is almost over 40 years, but really kicking into high gear in the last 15 years with my scholarship work and all of my studies, including I'm right now working on a book that is going to be published by McFarland called The Playwright's Journey that will come out in 2021, which is another sort of narrative of Eugene O'Neill's life and work, but from the perspective of a playwright.
So, but just to go back a little bit, Herman, sure. I mean, in terms of, like, it seems like there's a direct relationship between your interest in O'Neill and your engagement with O'Neill, and you even in the first place becoming a playwright in the first instance, if I'm understanding you correctly, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there were many connections between me and O'Neill coming up, and that's, I think, part of the reason why I'm writing this book is because I think O'Neill's life and his trajectory creates a kind of a roadmap for many playwrights who are interested in making their way into this amazing and wonderful and sometimes frustrating but always wonderful career. You know, Tony Kushner, who has talked about Eugene O'Neill very often, does basically say that you can't be a playwright unless you read O'Neill, because, again, of that mapping, that journey, as it were, that he goes through, and how he made a life of it from the ages, like 23 until he passed in 1953. I also just have some personal connections to him. It turned out because I grew up in Washington Heights, and my parents were split, and I lived in Riverdale in the Bronx for the latter half of my teens. And, you know, come to find out that Eugene O'Neill went to school at Mount St. Vincent's Academy. He had his first Holy Communion at the church there in 1900. And it turns out I had my first Holy Communion across the street from it at St. Margaret's Parish on Riverdale Avenue. So then there's been other connections as well. With regard to O'Neill, I've been to all of his homes in France, as well as in New London and even out in California. And so I pretty much dedicated not all of my life, but much of my life to just keeping tabs on him. And what's so fascinating about O'Neill and the study of O'Neill is that it's an unending journey, because there's so much that he left behind in terms of his legacy, in terms of his writing, in terms of his impact on other authors, that there's just a wealth of information that continues to come out. And that's why we have these conferences every 3 years with folks bringing forth new discoveries.
So, from the point of view, I guess, of the initial hook was how his journey as a playwright can kind of, inspire or be instructive for other playwrights. That's kind of how you initially kind of really gravitated towards his work. Am I correct in interpreting you in that way, Herman?
That's correct. I mean, he lived a very fascinating and, one could argue, horrific life up until the moment he began writing, because of what had happened to his mother. I guess it's kind of a spoiler if anyone wants to read Long Day's Journey Tonight, but what is revealed in the play that he wrote at the end of his career in 1940 and 41 is the fact that his mother was a morphine addict, and she'd gotten hooked on morphine because of his birth, because of a rough pregnancy, and a doctor prescribed it for her and did nothing to get her off of it. And she remained an addict throughout his youth. And that, as well as his father's struggle with alcohol and his oldest brother's as well as and his, all makes its way into O'Neill's play, Long Day's Journey Tonight. But his journey into playwriting begins around 1913, a year after he had attempted suicide. He tried to kill himself in 1912, and one could argue that that was at the end of a long series of horrible things that he had undergone as a result of being in that household, but even his own life choices about engaging with prostitutes as a sort of first sexual encounter, and that was actually egged on by his brother, and that all happened when he was 14 years old, and he began drinking really heavily even at that young age. He ended up having a child with a woman who he married, but he very clearly did not have an interest in being a father or being in this marriage, and so he ran away to sea, and he came back after all of that. And his life at sea is a fascinating journey, but when he came back feeling so guilt-ridden and being asked to actually divorce himself from his wife, he was asked to kind of engage in an interesting performance. He was to go to a brothel on 43rd Street in Times Square and get caught being with her, so that they could prove, back in those days, he needed some proof of fault by one of the parties to a divorce, and so he had to prove that he was an adulterer. And I've always thought that it must have been truly ironic for him to be performing this notion of being caught with a prostitute, when in truth he had been mostly with prostitutes up until that point in his life. And add on top of that, the place where he is having this alleged affair is a block and a half away from the place where he was born. He was born in Times Square at Barrett House, which then became the Cadillac Hotel, and remained there until the 1940s. And he was always aware of that house and that building being there. He would point it out constantly, even as far as 1946. He's quoted as lamenting the fact that it was torn down while he was out in California. He joked and said nobody had called me to ask if it would be okay. So he had a connection to that area. And so after that whole performance took place, and he'd done what he needed to do to get the divorce because he was being kind to the woman that he had married, Kathleen Jenkins. He made his way downtown to a place where he had been living on and off between his journeys to sea, and there at a place called Jimmy the Priest, which is the location of one of his great plays, The Iceman Cometh, which is set in 1912. But in 1912, or just at the new year, the early part of the year, he decided to kill himself, and he went and got some Veronal tablets, some sleeping pills, and overdosed on them. And fortunately for all of us, survived it. Woke up the next day, his friends revived him, took him to Bellevue, and he was, in his own account, reborn after that. There's something about that journey downward, pretty much from the moment that he had learned of his mother's addiction at the age of 14, and the drinking and the prostitutes and all of that, had kind of sent him on about a 7-year downward journey. He called it tobogganing in one of his short stories. And he basically made his way down that chute. When he came down up to the bottom of it all, he fortunately, like I said, for all of us, came out the other end alive and felt that he had been reborn and that he might have some purpose in life as a result of that. He then, unfortunately, contracted tuberculosis at the end of that year and ended up going into a sanitarium in Connecticut for a while. And again, fortunately, unfortunately, he wasn't that ill. He was able to survive it, even though many people died of what was known as consumption in those days. But he survived it. Basically spent several months sitting on a porch, sleeping on a porch and sitting on a porch that had sun coming into it directly. That was the cure, and fresh air. And he started writing, and that was his journey. He began right there to write plays. He had been writing poetry the year before, but at that point he turned to the writing of plays. And so I think for all playwrights, there's this interesting thing that happens at some point when we discover that we need to write, that because of our life experiences, because of something that we know that we feel we have to express, we make our way to this fantastic form that's been around 2,500 years of playwriting, which is to pull together plot and character and ideas and language and even music and spectacle. And I just cited Aristotle's six elements of drama. But basically by pulling all those together in one place, in a play that proceeds over 1 or 2 or 3 hours, it's a tough thing to do. I teach it. It's a very hard thing to learn. But it's also something that I do know playwrights that are before me, and it's because they've got something very complex that they're trying to work out. And I think when, again, if you watch and study O'Neill, not only from the beginning but all the way through, you see how an artist is struggling all the way through with every single play. If the play isn't a struggle to get through, if it's just an idea that ends up in one of his workbooks or his notebooks, as he even said, it doesn't. Through it. It doesn't come forward. But if it's something that's just gnawing at you, it's in the back of your brain, it comes to the fore, you can't let it go, then you probably have a play, and especially if it's something complex, because plays are quite complex, and audiences expect that as well.
One of, O'Neill is, identified as an iconic American, playwright and writer, and of course, or not of course, but one of the reasons we're particularly interested in him in these parts as well is because he had strong connections to Ireland. Can you tell me, Herman, and this is to educate me as much as it might be to educate, actually, some of my listeners probably know a lot more about this than I do, I'm embarrassed to admit, but can you tell me about how you you know, as someone who spent a lot of time studying him, how you locate him within his sense of a sense of ethnic identity, and specifically in terms of Irish-American identity. I mean, it strikes me, I know the history in that he's born into a very quote-unquote Irish city demographically, right? There are a lot of Irish in New York, and they're you know, a little higher on the totem pole socioeconomically and culturally and in terms of acceptance probably than they had been, say, 50 years prior. How do you locate Eugene O'Neill within that landscape, Herman?
Oh, sure. But just one thing I just quickly touch on initially is that as just an American, he, that sounds so so Texan when I said that, but as an American, what he did was he put American drama on the worldwide map. That's what he is initially acclaimed for, because prior to O'Neill, as they say, there were no well-known playwrights on the North American continent.
Mm-hmm.
It is only when he starts to get recognized, not only in New York but globally, productions in London and in Russia and in Ireland and across the world, that we start to see not only O'Neill's reputation rise, but American drama in particular. And he sort of lays again the groundwork or the path for other playwrights to come thereafter. And you know, he was esteemed by the American playwright community by winning four Pulitzer Prizes, but the big thing is that in 1936 he won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But going back to your question about his ancestry, so he's the son of two first generation Irish American families. His mother was a Quinlan, and they came from Tipperary. And they had, but she was born in the United States. His father, James, was born in Ireland, but at a young age, with his family, made his way to Buffalo, New York. They came out of New Ross, Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
For a while there, the scholars had thought Kilkenny, because mm-hmm. that was what O'Neill was told, and he didn't have the kind of Ancestry.com that we have now.
Yeah, and they would be close by geographically.
They were close by, yeah. I was just there in October, so I went actually through Kilkenny on the way to, or on the train and went past it on the way to New Ross. But essentially, it's been discovered that he came from there, and interestingly enough, there's a famine ship that's there now it's a replica of one of the ships that would have sailed out of New Ross and made its way to the United States during the famine. And so both the Quinlans and the O'Neills did come over during that time period. O'Neill's father, his father, Edward O'Neill, actually abandoned young James O'Neill and the rest of his family. I think he was about 6 years old. And he had some premonition, apparently, of his impending death, and went back to Ireland. And so young James and his siblings had to make their own in America. And, you know, in the 1850s, 1860s, that's a really tough thing to kind of get through. And they did their best. He never was fully educated. He went to, I think, a machine shop to work initially. By the time of the 1860s and the war, one of his brothers went off into the Civil War, and he ended up and his family making their way to Cincinnati. And there he, the story goes, was involved in some billiards playing a game of pool, and a manager of one of the plays that was coming in featuring the great actor Edward Forrest asked if anybody would be willing to come in to help be basically a supernumerary, which is basically a person who stands in the background on stage. But he did it at the National in Cincinnati in the 1860s, and he got the bug, and he just loved being on stage. And then he subsequently made a conscious effort to lose his Irish brogue and to make his way into the American theater as an O'Neill. They did ask him to change his name, and because of his great Irish pride, he refused to do so, and went on to become basically one of the great American actors of the latter half of the 20th century. A common joke about the two O'Neills is that for a while there, Eugene O'Neill was always being referenced as being the son of. And he said famously, around the time he began writing, he goes, at some point, I'll be known as Eugene, and James will be known as the father of. And so O'Neill was, the father was nationally famous, on a real celebrity. I always teach my students the fact that the popular entertainment, especially across the 19th century, in theater, in music halls, circuses, but certainly in theater and opera, rose to the kind of status level of film and television stars now. And they were well known because they made their way across the country, as O'Neill did, James O'Neill. And he's also known for portraying one particular role, Edmond Dantes, in The Count of Monte Cristo, that he appeared in 1882, I think, and then in 1883 he bought the rights to it and owned it for the rest of his life, which provided for him a wonderful income, and he proceeded to perform that play pretty much for the rest of his life, much to his lament, as portrayed by his doppelganger character in Long Day's Journey into Night. In that play, O'Neill, Eugene portrays his father as lamenting the fact that he had taken on that role and that that role had trapped him because he could not perform anything else. His audience really loved him in that really melodramatic play, and he felt that he would have been better served if he had continued on doing what he was doing best, which is playing major roles in Shakespearean performances, along with the great Edmund Booth. And Booth is also a great New York actor. It created the Booth Theater that was originally in Chelsea, and then now it's up in Times Square. Also the founder of the Players Club on Gramercy Park, which was a place for, honestly, for actors, thespians, to have a place to come and to be socially accepted. I teach theater history and point out that for centuries, the acting world, and actors in particular, were considered to be low-life and to be considered to be outside of society. And O'Neill and Booth and a variety of other performers in the late 1890s, 1880s, established the Players Club in order to bring them up in society. That's a very long answer to the question. I think I answered it all. Is that correct?
Yeah, and do you think, in that sense, in general, then you would say he had a positive affinity was he someone who went to St. Patrick's Day parades and, you know, engaged with Irish, you know, politics and stuff like that, or how would you put him on that scale, Herman?
Okay. Well, it evolved over time. So his father certainly was a proud Irishman and was raising his children to be proud of who they are and where they came from. But even as represented in Long Day's Journey Tonight, there was a lot of tension between the young boys of the O'Neill family and the father. It could be just straight-up rebellion that they weren't that interested in their ancestral homeland when they were young, as a way of digging at their father. They would, criticize him for his, as they referred to it in the play, his peasant roots, which of course is really truly insulting to say that to somebody. And so he acknowledges that in his play, but the truth is he did get the bug of Irish pride early on. Thanks to his father, he did start to study what was going on in Ireland, especially around the time that he's coming up as a playwright, because it is the time of the Easter Rebellion and then eventually all of the Civil War, as well as then the founding of the Republic. All of that's happening at the same time that he's coming of age as a playwright. And so he becomes, I wouldn't say political, but he just decides to start to educate himself a little bit more. His father went back to Ireland, I think, in 1906, right about the time of the founding of the Abbey Theatre, and so was really aware of what was going on in terms of the Gaelic revival or the Irish Renaissance in the early part of the 20th century in Dublin and Ireland, across Ireland. And so he brought back with him that kind of spirit, that notion that, yes, we're now going to start thinking about Irishness in a different light, in a positive light. And again, you know, many of your listeners probably know that, you know, that revival took place out of the kind of backlash, pushback against the stereotypical characterization of Irish characters that appeared not only in literature but on the Anglo and American stage, sort of the Irish stereotypical character, especially in America, was portrayed as a kind of a buffoon, a drunkard, sometimes a ne'er-do-well, but certainly not someone to be revered. And one of the critiques of O'Neill's early characterizations of Irish characters is that he kind of tipped into that a little bit early on, because that was a common kind of character, but he always gave them a life and a spirit and a truth and integrity that kind of went beyond the stereotype. So O'Neill early on is, I think, struggling with his sense of being Irish and his pride for it. But by the time you get into the 1930s and 1940s, he's full-fledged into a better understanding of his Irish ancestry. His father had died in 1920, and I think when you lose a parent, you start to let go of all that kind of resistance to the things they're trying to tell you, and you turn finally to listening to what they were trying to tell you, even though they're gone. And I think O'Neill had that kind of epiphany, and so he turned to a lot more study in the 1930s and 40s, and certainly a direct embrace of his Irish heritage. He was made a member of the Irish Academy in 1931, I believe, one of sort of the founding sort of associate members, and he was so proud of that to join the ranks of so many great Irish legends. And he had a correspondence with several Irish American playwrights and authors, and he continued that out through his life. But then he also started to correspond, particularly with Sean O'Casey, and other writers as well. And so he, like I said, he started to really not only embrace his heritage, but to really just publicly start to state to people that they had to look at him through the lens of his Irishness. He's got some quotes in the 1920s where he said, you know, you have to understand I'm Irish, an Irish American. And by the 1940s, he's making it very clear that needs to be understood. And it's partly also because of the work that he was doing in the 1940s. His last great plays, which I always point out were so interesting that they come after he wins the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's at the top of the world in terms of acclaim, and then he goes on to write Iceman Comet, Touch of the Poet, Long Days Dreaming Tonight, and Moon for the Misbegotten, while he's living out in California at a place called Dalhousie in Danville. But what's interesting about the works, the latter works, is with Moon for the Misbegotten and Long Day's Journey in Tonight and A Touch of the Poet, he has Irish characters being portrayed. In Touch of the Poet, there's a character by the name of Con Melody, who's actually the son of a bar owner from Galway who's made his way to America. He's got in both Long Day's Journey in Tonight and in Moon for the Misbegotten, the telling of a tale that was actually based on a true story of New London, Connecticut, of a character, an Irish American who was born in Ireland, who had been brought up in New London, who owned a small piece of property that the O'Neills rented to him. and he was a real, let's just say, feisty character. His name was, I think, John Dolan, and his character is portrayed in O'Neill's two plays. In one play, he's called Shaughnessy, and in another, he's called Hogan. But it's all three, the real story and the actual play versions, are all based on apparently a true story about Dolan at some point getting into a kind of a fight in 1920 or 22 or 23 with his next door neighbor, who was the wealthy it's either Edward S. Harkness, who was the head of Standard Oil, who owned property right down there, right not too far from New London, or it's a gentleman by the name of Hammond. But the point is that both of them were these patrician English-born or English-raised families, Americans, but still sort of the upper class. And here was this plebe, this Irish plebe, who was defying them. And the real battle between the two of them was the fact that Dolan and then Shaughnessy and Hogan let loose their pigs into next-door neighbor's ice pond. And as a result of that, there was a complaint about the pigs being in his water, and that's where he got his ice from. And so there's this big moment when this Brahmin shows up to this small shack of a house and doesn't physically challenge him, but does attempt to threaten him with lawsuits and a whole bunch of other things. And Dolan, as well as his character doppelgangers, tell him what so, as they would say. They just basically run circles around him linguistically, which is fascinating in both scenes. And basically has the gentleman running before he can even say a word. He's so twisted around by the gift of gab. And so it's a wonderful moment. And again, it's O'Neill embracing all of his Irish heritage from top to bottom. And so it's just a lovely moment in the theater. But also, interestingly enough, O'Neill decided to shoot it two times. In Long Day's Journey into Night, it's described. And in A Moon for the Disbegotten, it's actually performed. There's actually a scene in the play where we see all that take place.
It's really fascinating, Herman. And you mentioned there earlier the fact that he has, I guess, as from a historian's point of view, what we would call sources, he has left, I think what you're referring to is kind of paper trails, and his reach has been broad and disparate, which is probably a good thing in terms of people continuing to explore him and things like that. And I guess that segues to something that I guess a letter that was miscategorized in terms of an archive the wedding certificate, is it? Can you tell us a little bit about that journey in terms of documents pertaining to his marriage to Carletta Monterey, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, and then exchanges with, of course, the well-known Irish writer Sean O'Casey. Can you tell us a little bit about your explorations in those realms?
Sure. Well, so over the last year, I've been doing much of my research for this book that I'm working on for McFarlane called The Playwright's Journey. And so I've been spending some time in the O'Neill archives, and the two largest ones are one at Connecticut College, and there are actually the collections of one of O'Neill's first biographers, Lewis Schaefer, who's actually from Louisville, lived in Brooklyn, and wrote two volumes of the biography of Eugene O'Neill in the 1960s and early 70s. And then there's another set of papers at Yale at the Beinecke Library that O'Neill himself and Carlotta, his wife, they kept feeding it. They kept sending documents there over their lifetime, and then dedicated, even after both their deaths, documents, plays, correspondence, memorabilia. It's a huge treasure trove at the Beinecke. Well, I was there in March last year, 2019, and on my last day, I pulled a file that, interestingly enough, I'd come to find out is actually a new set of files. There's two sets of files at the Beinecke. One is Eugene O'Neill Papers Edition, and the other is the Winnick Papers relating to Eugene O'Neill. And I just started going through the Eugene O'Neill Papers Edition, and interestingly enough, not really realizing that it was a quote-unquote edition. I'd been to the archive over the years, and when I saw this, it didn't trigger in my head that this was literally a new treasure trove of documents. So the first thing that happened to me was literally at 3 o'clock in the day that I was going to leave at 6, I come across, as I'm flipping through this archive, and I was mindful of Robert Caro's famous comment, to turn every page. The advice that was given him as a young journalist, and that's why he's been such a great biographer. And I've made it my mission while I was there this time to make sure I turned every page. And so I turned the page and of the settled documents that were listed in this file that was supposed to be for everyone with the letter C. And I'd been seeing a lot of correspondence with O'Neill's first biographer, a gentleman by the name of Barrett Clark. But that's all backstory as to why I went to this file. But as I'm going through it, all of a sudden I see this one-page handwritten letter that's written on both sides, and it's an original, and it's in the papers. And I turn it over, and I read through it quickly. I see some mentions of a couple people that O'Neill knows, and it's dated November 25th, 1936, and it's signed Sean. And almost immediately, I thought of Sean O'Casey. So this is 2019. In 2017, I had gone to Galway for that conference, and I had done research on O'Neill's Irish heritage, and particularly focusing on even his connection to Sean O'Casey. So I knew that relationship, and then once I started to really read through the letter, I could tell it was Sean O'Casey's letter to Eugene O'Neill. And so I took pictures of it, put it back where it was, again noting that it was probably in the wrong place because it should have been under O instead of C. But I did quickly think that it was probably something new because there was no mention of this letter. It was a 1936 letter. What's beautiful about it, it's a congratulatory letter from Sean O'Casey to Eugene O'Neill for his Nobel Prize for Literature, November 25th. It's about, I think, about 3 or 4 weeks after the world had heard that O'Neill had been awarded the Nobel Prize. Mm-hmm. And so this began a very interesting journey for me in the provenance of the document, one that's still not complete. But I'll just tell you quickly what happened was I left the library and immediately called my friend Robert Dowling, who, if you haven't had him on your show, you should have him on at some point. Rob Dowling is really the great O'Neill scholar, and certainly in his Irish heritage as well. Rob is a professor at Connecticut State College, a full professor there, and he's the president of the Eugene O'Neill Society. He's the author of 2014 of the last great biography of Eugene O'Neill called Life in Four Acts by Rob Dowling. And so I called Rob up and I said, "Have you heard of this?" And I immediately read it to him, and he said no. And then I made a few more phone calls to a couple of other O'Neill scholars, including reaching out to the editor of the Eugene O'Neill Review, a gentleman by the name of Alex Pettit, who is down at Texas Tech University. He also said he hadn't heard of it. And then he at some point recommended that I reach out to the O'Casey estate and see if they recognize it. I sent the picture off to a lawyer in London who then sent it on to Siobhan O'Casey, who very quickly got back and said, "Yeah, it looks like her father's handwriting, and it does look like something he would have written." And it did, and everybody did acknowledge that it had never been seen before. And then Christopher Murray, who is the scholar of O'Neill's, Sean O'Casey's life, Sean O'Casey, a writer at work back in the early part of the century, I also contacted him, and he also confirmed that it was O'Casey's hand and O'Casey's writing. And such a wonderful letter because, again, the congratulations that are contained within it. It references an interesting moment in O'Casey's life. He had just published a work where he was critical of the critics that were he felt standing in the way of really great work in Ireland and England as well. A book called The Flying Wasp, and he actually references it in the letter. But mostly he's just corresponding with his dear old friend, Eugene O'Neill, who he had actually met about 1934, so about 2 years earlier. The wonderful critic George Dean Nathan had put the two playwrights together, and the story goes it was like an immediate love affair. They hugged each other, and they felt like they had known each other their whole entire lives. You know, Casey gave O'Neill the great compliment of telling him that he writes like an Irishman. And so the two of them hit it off and continued correspondence. And there's other correspondence between the two of them that continues on. But there's no correspondence by O'Neill back to O'Casey. And then continue on with the story about like how this document got lost and why there really isn't a responsive letter. I wonder if O'Neill ever really saw it. Or if he did, if he had time to respond, because immediately after winning the Nobel Prize, there was a lot of back and forth with he and his wife having to correspond. They were out in Seattle when they had heard that he had won this great award, and they were selling their house in Georgia that they had lived in for the previous several years. And so Carlotta went back to Georgia, and this was right after O'Neill had come down with appendicitis, and he was actually in the hospital for about 3 months. So there's a lot of sturm and drang amongst the O'Neill family during this time period, and it's possible that the letter itself probably got misplaced as a result of all of that. No one's fault, but there it is. But then the big, really interesting thing that's actually going to be future scholarship on my part is this collection of letters that the O'Casey letter was found within. Apparently, the O'Neills, Carlotta, and Eugene had created their own kind of filing system beginning in 1928 when they began their relationship together. They were married subsequently in 1929 and lived together until 1953 when he died in Boston. But what they had was an A to Z file, basically, just like any one of our sort of manila folder, kind of foldover file folders that you can fit documents within, and it has a little tab at the top you could write whatever the name of the file is. And they had an A, a B, a C, a D, all the way to Z, as well as within it, if it was a big topic or a big person with a lot of correspondence, they would get their own file, but all of it placed alphabetically. Well, apparently this giant treasure trove of A to Z files was handed over to the Beinecke Library in two sets in 2009, I believe, and then also in 2012. And so this is new scholarship that's going to be available to or new documents that are available to the scholarly community. And I call it a treasure trove because it is. It's several thousand documents. And what the A to Z files are, there are other files as well, but the A to Z files are the incoming correspondence that O'Neill received from across the world. So it's original holograph letters of correspondence from a variety of different artists and novelists. And there's a lot of really interesting documentation contained within it, and in many ways it'll provide for us in the O'Neill community a better understanding of, one, the correspondence that he was sending out, the context for it, but also in the cases where he didn't respond, we learn a little bit more about O'Neill, sort of been focused on a lot of his correspondence he received after The Iceman Cometh was sent around, before it was published, between like 1940 and 46. He sent it around to a bunch of wonderful people who commented on it. And he, this correspondence also received from his family is really eye-opening, especially one of the things I found really kind of sad and tragic is the correspondence from his son, Shane O'Neill, who ended up being a heroin addict and committing suicide in 1970, long after O'Neill died. But there was a big fallout between O'Neill and his son, and the correspondence kind of gives us all a better understanding of at least Shane's perspective on the whole thing. And so it's, again, a long answer, but that's, you're talking to somebody who's been studying this for 40 years. So
yeah, no,
Herman,
a treat. And I'm very grateful for your generosity. I didn't anticipate that that we'd be on the line for so long, but this is just, you know, it's an indulgence, and I think our listeners will appreciate hearing the insights of someone who has so forensically, and you know, over time, that kind of sensitivity and nuance and the,
right.
the grit that that someone who, only someone who has really embedded themselves with someone over a period of time in terms of studying them and looking at them creatively and historically and in all the other ways that you have. It's really fascinating stuff, Herman. I'm so delighted that we've made this connection with you here in terms of your research and knowing about all that you've done and you're continuing to do in terms of the O'Neill story. And thank you for coming on today to chat about it. So I guess this is a good whetting of the appetite, I suppose, for your book, which you said will come out in 2021. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. It's called The Playwright's Journey, yes.
Wow, that's something for us to look forward to, and please, I know we'll be in touch before that, but make sure that that's on our radar so we can let people know. He does seem like a fascinating study, and
right.
I, for one, am grateful for the opportunity today to learn more about him. Thank you so much, Herman, for taking the time to come on This Irish American Life.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.